When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode, sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and miniseries. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate welcomes Greg Beats to discuss his book, A Curious Mix of People, The Underground Scene of 90s Austin. This is a special episode for Nate as he was a participant in the scene as a fanzine writer, club booker, and band member. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by an old friend of mine, Greg Beats, the co-author of a book called A Curious Mix of People, The Underground Scene of 90s Austin. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Sure, it's a pleasure. And this is a scene that we both knew pretty well. Tell us what the book is about.
Well, basically, the book is about the underground music scene of Austin during the 1990s. And it gets a little bit sticky going from the 80s into the 90s and the 90s into the aughts. But just for the sake of bookending it, we kind of focused on basically going 90 to 99. And we were kind of fortunate to have two sets of events, one in 1990 and one in 1999, that kind of allowed us to do this. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, one of the things that we picked up on while we were doing the interviews that we did, because this is kind of like an oral history book, Tim Kerr from the Big Boys, who were, you know, very much a seminal 80s Austin band, talked about basically that you can't really say that it, you know, started at this point and stopped at that point. It really is a very fluid scene. But I think we wanted to kind of put the 90s under a microscope in Austin, simply because we felt that the 70s had kind of been written about with the rise of the Armadillo World Headquarters, and then of course the fall of the Armadillo World Headquarters. To some extent, I think the 80s has been covered pretty well with the coalescence of punk rock in Austin around Raoul's Club. I think Pat Blaschel, who's another author here in town, has done a really good book, a photo essay called Texas is the Reason, which chronicles that scene really well. so we just kind of felt that there was a bit of a drop off with the 90s. And it wasn't, even though there were a lot of people who made the jump from the 80s to the 90s, it wasn't quite the same thing. There was a, you know, a new generation of people coming up and starting bands, and a new energy. And at the same time, it was sort of the end of the way of doing a lot of things in terms of how, you know, how you subsist in a local band. And we kind of get into that, those sort of social and cultural economic factors about, you know, how things changed in the local music scene from the 90s into the aughts, how Austin itself changed, kind of went from being a big town to a small city during that period. And just sort of putting the whole thing in the microcosm of how music itself kind of changed from the 80s to the 90s. So there are a lot of different cross currents going on there, but we're kind of viewing the whole thing through this, you know, what we call a curious mix of people, the participants of the music scene in Austin during the 90s, the people who were in the bands, the people who were DJs on the local non-commercial radio stations, the people who ran the record stores, the club owners, and so on and so forth. So that's in a rather large nutshell, I think that's what we're doing here.
And so this isn't Liverpool in the 60s or even Seattle in the 90s. I mean, nobody came out of this scene and conquered the world. There wasn't really, like, even the 80s Austin scene, there was an aesthetic that had a national impact, at least on an underground level, with bands like the Butthole Surfers and the Big Boys and even Poison 13, you know, influencing underground rock across the country. But the Austin 90s scene, there's a few bands that coulda, shoulda, woulda, or were expected to or hoped for. I mean, like, what's the significance of this, and why should people care about it? Is there some bigger story that it connects to or plugs into, that beyond just what some people did back in the day?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, it's definitely a question. Probably the first thing our book editor asked us when we walked into UT Press and presented this idea. You know, I think, you know, you can definitely look at the 90s that way. There were a lot of bands from Austin who got close during the 90s. Some of the more significant ones would have been 16 Deluxe and you know, Syncola. You know, I think Spoon was definitely a band who you know, emerged in the 90s, found themselves you know, on Matador Records, made the jump to Elektra Records, and lasted all of one album there because there was kind of a change in the regime. And they actually sort of took a tongue-in-cheek approach to it by putting out a single that kind of poked fun at their former A&R person. You know, so I think, you know, Spoon was the exception. I think a lot of bands that kind of went through that ringer, you know, came out of it, and I think, you know, may have, you know, felt dispirited or what have you, and a lot of those bands broke up. Spoon was, you know, I think what happened with Spoon is that even though they didn't really reach their pinnacle until the next decade, and certainly Spoon has since gone on to, you know, have you know, a string of pretty well selling by today's standard you know, definitely critically acclaimed albums. You know, I'd still kind of consider them to be a product of that 90s scene. And I think if you talk to Britt Daniel, he'd probably agree that, you know, the same thing could probably be said for, and you will notice by the Trail of Dead, definitely a band that came out of Austin, by way of, Olympia and other points along the way, in the later 90s, you know, found themselves, on, you know, one of the last bands on the local label Trans Syndicate here in Austin, then made the jump over to Merge and ultimately to Interscope. And I think in 2001, I think is when Source Tags and Codes came out, which sold reasonably well, got very critically acclaimed. And then another example of a 90s band, maybe we can call them slow growers. I think that ended up, didn't make much of a splash during the 90s, but did ultimately, make some pretty big accomplishments was, Cherubs. Those guys, came together in the early 90s, played, started playing a few shows, around, places like The Cavity, which was a, very kind of squatty underground club in Austin during the early 90s. Calling it a club might not even be proper. It really was a squat of all things. But those guys got on Trance Syndicate, put out one really great album. Their really great one was Heroin Man. Which was just a fantastic record, one of the best records I think that came out of Austin during the 90s. But by the time it actually came out, those guys had gone on tour and had a rough time on tour, and they'd split up. But then, 20 something years later, they get back together and record To Infinity, which sounds like they picked up right where they left off. I mean, it was like, to me, every bit as good, is what those guys were doing, back in the 90s, and have since, kind of gotten the career maybe that they always, maybe could have had if they would have stayed together. So, those are just, three bands that came out of Austin in the 90s, but it just took a while for them to come out of Austin. To your point, I mean, it was at the time, if you would have been there, and you were there, it was sort of this, situation where, this band looks like they're going to be the one to break, and, they've gotten signed to a label, and good. Now they're going out on tour. Good. And, maybe they have a song in a movie or something. Maybe they have a song that gets picked up by college radio. But something, would always kind of maybe knock them off the game a little bit, or they just couldn't quite make that jump. And there's a lot of, a lot of people have a lot of ideas about maybe why that is. I know when we talk to people in the book, Brant Bingaman from the band Pocket Fisherman, who are definitely a band that would do really well in Austin during the 1990s, and they continue to play out even now. Once they left Austin, they did not translate outside of Austin for whatever reason. I know Brant would talk about, maybe it's just the fact that we're goofy, and we're doing, our lyrics are kind of perverted, and, we're being funny, and maybe funny doesn't make sense in other markets.
I just want to jump in quickly because I kind of want to play the Cherubs. I want to play a song from Heroin Man. Oh. This is a song called Dave of the Moon, about a guy named Dave DeLuna that was part of the scene who died from a heroin overdose. So this is the Cherubs, Dave of the Moon. And that was Dave of the Moon from the Cherubs' undersung Heroin Man album on Trance Syndicate. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Pocket Fisherman and that whole sort of I would sort of classify the Pocket Fisherman with Squat Thrust and some other bands, that there was a definitely a connective tissue to the sort of Butthole Surfers, or an echo of the Butthole Surfers scratch acid scene that Pat Blashill talked about in his Texas in the Reason book. And the Cherubs are definitely part of that, but without the funny. They were much more. They could have easily fit on Amphetamine Reptile or even Sub Pop, maybe. They were very much sort of a noise rock or even grunge band of that period. But there was definitely a comedy aspect. But I think one thing about the scene that I'd like to say, though, from my experience of it, it wasn't. I mean, there was definitely an aspect, like if you read the Austin Chronicle, there would be sort of a certain excitement about, oh, this band or that band is going to make it, or, you know, there's this or that record, you know, with South by Southwest, there were record companies in town every year. But mostly it was just every weekend there was a whole fuck ton of bands playing really cool music and having a lot of fun. And I honestly don't know of another city that was swarming the way Austin was, even if it never coalesced into anything that rocked the nation or, you know, dramatically socially coalesced. But I want to bring up another band that I think did kind of represent something unique, and that was the Fuck Emos, or Fuck Emos. Like, tell us about them, their name, and just kind of the way they epitomize the ethos of that period.
Well, I mean, I think the Fuck Emos are probably one of the most unlikely success stories to emerge from Austin music, or really music anywhere, because, you know, those guys started as a band called, called Warthog. And, if you would have seen them when they were just getting started at the Cavity, it was just, you know, a squall of noise. And, you know, the singer Russell Porter, who also doubled on trombone, would sing through this this pitch shifter that I believe he bought it like Toy Joy. I mean, so it wasn't like a professional piece of equipment. It was something that they would somehow manage to patch into the PA, and it would make his voice go very low and evil. You know, kind of like someone who's possessed in a horror movie or something. And he would sing with this voice. And, the origin of the name Fuck Emos came about, because I guess at one point his wife was in Emos, and I think he wanted to go in and get her, but it was after closing time, and they wouldn't let him come in. And, so I think they put Fuck Emos on their drum head one day, and just basically, and then decided that was the name. And Dave Herman, who was one of the owners of the Cavity, and who was kind of serving as their manager, was, you know, and it was like, are you sure you want to do that? Which is a rare show of restraint from someone like Dave, rest in peace. And they said, no, we're the Fuck Emos now. And so that became that. And then they made a tape of these songs that they had. And I think they went out and bought a whole bunch of just cheap tapes from a dime store or something like that, and just duped them off and gave them away for free. And suddenly, I think everybody realized that Russell was actually a really great songwriter. And there was this, even though the songs were sort of evil and grungy and dark, there was also sort of this underlying pop ethos in them. The two things worked together in just a magnificent way that you would have never you would have never expected. And so, yeah. And the irony, of course, is that from the time that tape came out, it wound up on the jukebox at Emos, and everybody at Emos thought it was hilarious. And they became the Fuck Emos became one of the most popular bands of the era that played Emos.
They certainly did. And I was pausing just for a second because I want to make sure that the song that I want to play is available on YouTube, and it is. And so let's go ahead and hear the Fuck Emos. And this gets to right to their pop heart. This is Do You Want to Dance?
Baby, do you wanna dance tonight? When I saw you from across the dance floor, gee, it felt so good to be alive. Your eyes were looking into mine.
And that was the Fuck Emos, Do You Want to Dance? Which, yeah, I think sums up everything wonderful and terrifying about that band. And, I mean, I remember the first time I saw them walking into a club and I didn't know what Rohypnol was. And then I swear, you know, within 15 minutes, I had a thorough education about all the uses of Rohypnol. You could just see sort of a case study. And this was before it was infamous as the date rape drug. It was strictly a pharmaceutical being misused as recreational. And
it really was. I mean, it was, I think the first time I ever heard of it being used as a date rape drug was like years after it had kind of become a relatively popular drug within Austin simply because of the city's proximity to Mexico. People could go down there and buy it and bring it back and sell it.
And it was much in demand and it, you know, it really, really wrecked people. But you talked a little bit about the clubs and you kind of structured the book around the clubs and the scene. And the Cavity, tell us a little bit more about the Cavity, because it's a pretty unique story, and it really did launch this scene or incubate this scene. What was the Cavity? How can a club be a squat? You know,
well, I think in this case, the club was a squat because the people who owned and ran the club lived there. Even though it was, I don't think it was zoned for residency. It certainly wasn't fit for any kind of decent residency. But
it wasn't fit to be a club. I mean, it didn't even have a ceiling in part of it. It was just a space between two buildings, really.
Basically, that's what it was. I mean, what it had been before the Cavity moved in, immediately before the Cavity moved in, there was a very strange quasi-religious environmental group that sort of had some cult-like tendencies called Zendix. The Zendix had their, I guess it would have been kind of like their squat living there, and that they were led by a really kind of freaky-looking old guy named Wolf Zendik, who would go on public access television and, you know, scream about, "You motherfuckers are destroying the planet," and, you know, just crazy stream of consciousness stuff. And it was always just, you know, just, yeah, very, very weird scene. And then the Cavity took it over, and I think in some ways it got even weirder after that. It was run, I think Jimmy Bradshaw from the band Squat Thrust, I think helped put up some of the money to get the club off the ground. And then Starin Wagner was of all the people, I think in that mix, you know, sort of as close to a you know, stoic voice of reason as you were probably likely to find. And then, you know, Dave Herman, I think, was the guy with the PA, and he was the guy who was kind of the face of the Cavity. And he was a very he looked a lot like Frank Zappa. He was kind of a very strange looking dude and a guy who was, you know, just always up for whatever sort of mayhem and trouble that he could kind of get himself into. And so there was just, you know, there was a groundswell of bands, newer bands that were happening at the time. Those bands didn't really have a whole lot of places to play. There was the Cannibal Club, which was a great club for its time, but that was just one club. So it was very difficult for all of these bands to actually get on a proper stage. And so, you know, bands would find themselves playing house parties and co-op parties near University of Texas over in West Campus and that sort of thing. And then very rarely, you know, would they find themselves getting a proper club gig. And then when the Cavity opened, suddenly, you know, these same bands that would have had trouble getting a gig at a place like Cannibal simply because they just had such a wealth of bands to choose from, would find themselves, you know, headlining a 3 or 4 band bill at the Cavity. And the Cavity was it was a BYOB club, so they did not get hassled by the state alcoholic beverage commission. One of the most amazing things about the Cavity, I think, is that you know, if a 12-year-old kid wanted to go there, a 12-year-old kid could go there, and they would have, you know, they had you know, G.G. Allen play one of his most infamous shows ever at the Cavity, where you know, he did his normal poo flinging and all that stuff, but then someone set off tear gas and the police showed up, and it was, you know, just a full-on melee. And yeah, you could have, you know, if you were an unknowing parent, you could have dropped off your 12-year-old at the club at that show. You know, would have been quite an education, you know, might, you know, in that case might've been better off just, you know, going over to Antone's and seeing a blues band or something.
Yeah. Might've been less frightening unless they sold you some heroin. There was, you know, dropping mentioning that, you know, dropping off a kid though makes me think of the terrible incident where somebody was picked up at the Cavity and then abducted and murdered, and the police suddenly were very interested. And do you know the story I'm going to, where the Fucking Most had a song? Yeah, tell us about that, how the Fucking Most found themselves under investigation after the police watched a video of their performance.
Well, they're one of the, you know, big tragedies in Austin at that time, that I believe took place toward the end of 1991, was what is locally referred to as the yogurt shop murders. And basically what happened is that someone or a group of people came into a I can't believe it's yogurt store in North Austin that was being closed up by a bunch of high school age girls, and basically murdered them and set the store on fire. And to this day, I mean, that they've never actually, you know, the case is still open. This was a huge crime, in Austin at the time, because Austin was really thought of as a very safe city. So it was a very rare thing to have happen. It got national media attention. It was the most notorious crime, I think, to happen in Austin since the UT Tower shooting. And the police, you know, I think got caught on their heels in a lot of ways. And, you know, they were under a lot of pressure, to make headway in the case, you know, didn't have a lot of forensic evidence to go on. And so one of the things among many different leads that they followed was that they called them PIBs at the time. It was People in Black. And they were convinced that perhaps some people who were involved in the local underground music scene may have had, you know, had some sort of, they were people of interest to the police. Let's just put it that way. There was a band that played the Cavity pretty often called Vampire Bondage Club. I know that they found themselves under a bit of scrutiny. There was actually one person, and I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but I remember like 48 Hours did which was the CBS News magazine, showed the police raiding the house of a woman who had like a skull or something. And of course the skull turned out to be plastic. This was just like a woman who happened to be kind of like a death rocker or a goth, as we might call them today. So this is what was going on in Austin. There was a lot of paranoia. And I think the Fuck Emos, being the Fuck Emos, decided they would write a song about, you know, where they make reference to the
yogurt shop
murders.
called I Know Who Did It. And then the police took them.
So
police took them literally.
I think that's what it was, and it wasn't so much because people were you know, I think being irreverent toward the real tragedy that happened, I think it was more a commentary on, you know, on the fact that there was this bungled police response followed by this massive media explosion. And so, yeah, it was the kind of thing that it, given the timber of the time, people were going to do, you know, exercise some irreverence about, I guess.
For sure. And let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about more irreverent things that happened in Austin in the 90s.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
And so I want to talk about two clubs that kind of inherited the mantle of the Cavity, because the Cavity didn't last much longer than the G.G. Allin show. It drew too much attention, and it just wasn't an idea long for this world. I think it was essentially a crack house. and like, you know, functioning as a youth club, which, you know, but one of the clubs that came up while the Cavity was still going and kind of helped lead to the demise was a very commercial proposition. And the other one was the antithesis of that. And I'm talking about Emos and the Blue Flamingo. Tell us about those two clubs, how they were different and how they were yet still similar enough that there was kind of a pipeline of bands from the Blue Flamingo to Emos.
Well, Emos got its start as a club in Houston. The first Emo started there, I think in either the very late 80s or the very early 90s, and was started by a gentleman named, Eric Hartman, whose nickname was Emos. And I think people kept telling him, when they would come through Houston that you really need to, open a place in Austin. And so, the place that, Eric and company settled on was a club that was right at the corner of Six and Red River, which turned out to be a very strategic location, I think, because as the 90s progressed, original live music, you really stopped seeing as much of that, I think, on Sixth Street, and it really started kind of creeping more up Red River to the point where, like today, Red River, if you drive down there, they have street signs that let you know that you're in the Red River Cultural District. And, you know, there were clubs there, you know, obviously before Emos, you know, the Cavity and Chances just being two of them, and even going back to, the 70s and the 60s, you know, the 60s, you had the New Orleans club down there, which is where Rocky, Erickson and 34 Elevators played. And then, the One Night, is where, you know, Steve Ray Vaughan got his start. So, you know, there always been stuff down there, but I think Emos was kind of the fortress, if you will. And once Emos opened, you know, they had, two stages, one indoor, one outdoor, so they could present smaller shows. And then the outdoor stage probably had a standing probably in the neighborhood of 300 or 400 people. So you kind of had a small stage and a big stage, so they could operate on any given night. And if the small stage wasn't in use, people could come in and drink. And then they had a nice patio where people could carouse and, you know, get together or break up or what have you. And it was free to get in, which was huge. They made all of their money, at least early on, off of the bar. And even with that, I mean, they could afford to bring in bands like Killdozer and No Means No and John Spencer Blues Explosion and Jesus Lizard. So they'd bring in all these national acts that if you were in San Francisco or New York, you'd be paying upwards of, you know, $20 to go see them. And in Austin, you could see them for free. And then a lot of these local bands that had been previously playing the Cavity would get to open those shows, because there weren't bands weren't really going out on package tours as much. So it very often the local bands would get the opportunity to open, and they would get that exposure. So I think Emos was in some ways they took a lot of that energy that the Cavity helped harness. But, you know, handled it in a more proper, professional way that had a level of sustainability to it you kind of knew the Cavity, at any given moment could go down, because it really wasn't a business in the truest sense of the word.
No.
Put it that way. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to just comment that Emos was a music business juggernaut. This is where Johnny Cash played when his Rick Rubin produced album debuted in 1994. And just the sort of institution. And I think as much as any single club probably built modern Austin, or built the reputation of Austin as this world-class entertainment headquarters, that Antones and other clubs are pretty legendary, but none of them ever quite had the vibe of Emos on a big South by Southwest night, the way that you had the two stages, the indoor, outdoor, the doors on two corners. And also I want to mention the amazing artwork. The late Frank Kozik had a number of pieces. And I'm blanking on the names of Lindsey Kuhn had an amazing, it wasn't a mural, just a painting, a Texas serial killer homage, giant painting, that filled up a whole wall. And it really crystallized sort of the early 90s grunge aesthetic in a very deceptively commercially successful way. At the time, the tattoos and everything read as dangerous and everything, but they had packaged it just at the perfect time. And let's go ahead and hear our next song before we go back to the conversation. And this is Sincola's Bitch off the What the Nothing Head Said album. Was Rebecca Cannon of Sincola singing Bitch off their What the Nothing Head Said album. And, you know, Rebecca and Sincola were kind of the flagship of the scene for a long time. I mean, they were, seemed like always on the cover of the Chronicle or always playing a big show. And we haven't talked about the role of women in the scene, and particularly lesbian women. In the 80s, Austin was famous because, or not famous, but known for an unusually active gay presence in the punk scene. I mean, the lead singers are the Big Boys, the Dicks, MDC were openly gay, out and proud in a period of time when people like Michael Stipe or Bob Mould were very much closeted. And, you know, Austin was loud and proud with it. And in the 90s, it seemed like the lesbian scene came into its own. And not just lesbians, but also lots of women were active in the scene in a way that we hadn't seen in the 80s. And we're seen in very few scenes other than, I'd say, Olympia, Washington, in the 90s. Talk about Sincola and kind of... It wasn't ever articulated as girl power or Riot Girl or any of that kind of stuff. But talk about the femme presence in Austin Punk in this period.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that was really, and putting together the book with my co-author, Richard Weimark, I mean, the women we spoke to, I think, really filled in a lot of, I wouldn't necessarily call them blanks, in terms of our understanding of how things worked, but hearing their perspective, like for example, we've talked a lot about the Cavity, you know, talking with, you know, a lot of the men from the scene, they would, you know, they would say things like, you know, the Cavity was the spark, you know, that was a really big deal. And then, you know, we talked to the women and they're like, I don't know about that. It was kind of a shithole and it was kind of a scary place to go for a woman. Now, fortunately, I think one of the things that we had not far from the Cavity, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, was Chances. And Chances was ostensibly a lesbian bar that was just up the road from the Cavity, maybe a block and a half away, that had been opened by a woman named Sandra Martinez. And Sandra's, I think, you know, reading her accounts of it, unfortunately, we weren't able to talk with her for the book. But we, you know, just reading her contemporary accounts about, you know, how Chances came to be, she really wanted to open up. She wanted to have an open lesbian bar that wasn't behind shaded windows. They wanted, she was very much about being out, in terms of her business model, and live music was very much a part of it. And because there was live music there, there was the opportunity for, you know, straight heterosexual guys who might otherwise be like, you know, immersed in a very bro-y type culture, to come in and just see, you know, see these women who were doing bands. You know, I think, you know, if we're talking about the 80s into the 90s, I mean, everything Gretchen Phillips was doing back then with Two Nice Girls and later on solo, I think was super inspiring. Another band that emerged at that time that really broke up, I think, that, you know, before they could really get their due, was a band called Power Snatch. Cindy Widener, who was the singer of Power Snatch, we talked to her, and one of the things she said is that, you know, we really didn't need Riot Girl in Austin because we had Power Snatch. And I think it's hard to delineate the difference between, you know, what was coming out of Olympia at the time and what was coming out of Austin. But I think if I was going to do it, I would probably say that, you know, it was the women who were doing bands like Power Snatch were slightly older, probably weren't as strident politically, you know, say a band like Bikini Kill was, but were every bit as, you know, just totally full on, rocking in a unique way that just, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see that same sort of approach to it, from a group of dudes who'd spent too much time listening to, like, you know, Eddie Van Halen and Fogout or something like that. So, you know, it wasn't like that women were at the periphery of the scene. Women were right at the very heart of the scene. And like you said, I mean, you know, earlier, I mean, we talked a little bit about, you know, you know, Randy Biscuit Turner from the Big Boys and Gary Floyd from the Dicks, you know, out and proud gay men leading, you know, leading two of the big punk rock bands in Austin in the '80s. You know, if you go back to the very kind of beginnings of what we would come to know as punk rock in Austin, you know, I think arguably the first, you know, the first band that really kind of presented itself as a punk band would have been, you know, the Violators. And that was, you know, Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's when she was like all of about 17 years old. So there's always been a, you know, I think Austin's had a pretty good, you know, pretty good run of having women be integral to the scene. But I think in the '90s, it just, it really, it really kind of came together in a big way. And then, so you had, you know, slightly, you know, bands like Power Snatch, who were, you know, a group of slightly, you know, older, you know, older folks who were leading bands. Not, I don't want to say old, but, you know, they were older than the people who were like 21, 22 years old, the ones who were just coming up. And the ones who were young and just coming up would have been people like Rebecca Cannon from Syncola, and, you know, Carrie Clark from 16 Deluxe, you know, Michelle Rule from Miss Universe, Melissa Bryan from the Shindigs. There were, you know, quite a few of them at the time. And, you know, I certainly don't want to speak for, you know, for women in general, but just, you know, again, talking from, you know, the women we interviewed for the book, they, you know, the ones who would go out on tour would talk about how, you know, Austin, was just a more, you know, just a better atmosphere for women in music. You know, Carrie Clark talks about how, you know, she would go out and, the sound guy would either assume that she was, you know, a girlfriend or someone selling merch, or the singer, or if she was fortunate enough to be considered a musician, the guy would show up with a DI box because the assumption was that she was a bassist. there were a lot of stories like that. And yeah, so
the dreaded chick bass just player.
So just based on their stories, you know, we definitely had a really good crop of bands that, either were, entirely made up of women or who had women in very, prominent roles. And they were as integral to the scene, I think, as the men were. And I think speaking is a man who was involved in this whole scene, I feel like, you know, having those women there doing what they were doing, it just made the scene a much more, interesting, vibrant, fruitful, and more artistically, varied, scene than it would have been if it just would have been a bunch of dudes.
Yeah, for sure. And let's go ahead and hear a little bit of 16 Deluxe. This is 16 Deluxe doing Idea. That was 16 Deluxe doing Idea off their first album for Trans Syndicate. And let's talk a little bit about Trans Syndicate, because this is a record label founded and run by King Coffee, the drummer for the Butthole Surfers. And trance was as close to a sub pop of the scene as you could get. Tell us about kind of their different phases and what King managed to do with the Trans Syndicate.
Well, I think, you know, the moment King started trance is where we kind of pegged the beginning of our book. And, you know, basically the origin story of that was, you know, King had a little time off the road with the Buttholes and had, you know, I think always kind of smarted at the fact that, whenever they were dealing with, independent labels, they were always dealing with somebody, you know, in New York or California, and being in Texas, this before the internet, when long distance phone calls still cost a fair amount of money, it was difficult to maintain any kind of contact and develop any sort of relationship. So he on January 1st, 1990, made a New Year's resolution that he was going to start a record label that was going to put out Texas bands. I think one of the bands he immediately had his eye on was Ed Hall. Ed Hall had put out a couple of records up to that point on Boner Records, which was a label out of California. He was able to kind of corral Ed Hall and give them a local connection with a label. I think actually the first band on Trance was a band called Crust that, if you ever got a chance to see Crust, it was, quite a bit like the Butthole Surfers, only in some ways, maybe even a little bit more extreme.
If the lead singer was a televangelist, then that would have been.
Yeah, he would do he would present himself as a televangelist. But, as the show went on, it would just get grosser and grosser, and they would be playing these instruments that they built out of junk, and it was loud and cacophonous. And then by the end of the night, he might be wearing like nothing but duct tape underwear, and might be like, trying to set his pubic hair on fire with a lighter or pulling worms out of his pants. I mean, there was all sorts of just really strange stuff that happened when Crust was around. So, Ed Hall and Crust were the two bands, and those bands had already been around for a little while when the 90s started, but those were the two of the first bands that King put out. And then as things moved forward, we talked a little bit about the Cherubs. John Boy was another band that was a bit younger, newer of a band that King put out. Unfortunately, those guys didn't, they put out a really good record, Claim Dedications, and then promptly broke up and never really got a chance to, enjoy the fruits of that. And then right about the midpoint of Trance's arc was when 16 Deluxe happened. And, suddenly King had like an honest to goodness buzz band on his hands that, multiple major labels were kind of clamoring after. And, to hear 16 Deluxe talk about it, I mean, these guys were very, very new, really had not had a chance to even really be a local band for that long. And suddenly, they're talking about these, major label record contracts and everything. So, I think that all happened really, really fast for those guys. And, they did get to Warner Brothers and put out an album on Warner Brothers, and it, commercially didn't really do, I think, what anybody really wanted it to do. And so, they got out of that particular label deal. But that was probably the biggest flirtation I would say that Trance had with the mainstream. And then in the latter half of the 90s, I think, King and his spouse, Craig Stewart, who was also, really, I think, integral to the running of the label and finding these really great bands. I think they started looking at a lot of bands that were not necessarily kind of loud and in your face as much. So that was kind of how a band like Bedhead from Dallas came along and wound up on Trance. And Windsor for the Derby kind of had a little bit of a lighter electronic oriented sound, I think, was another band. American Analogs, that was a,
yeah, I'm glad you mentioned them. I'm glad you brought up Craig too. He was definitely integral to it, thinking of Craig and so many of the people that have passed or are still fighting horrible illnesses from the scene, it's a sort of the downside of being in your 50s, especially for a hard living scene like this, like so many of the people that were talked about in the book didn't live to tell their story in the book. And that's kind of a morbid side term, but you know, that's the nature of reality. And we didn't get to the Blue Flamingo particularly, but that was a legendary drag bar that was where the term A Curious Mix of People came from. And it was right next door to the Cavity, and that's where a lot of the bands played. And so it was the spirit of the Cavity kind of migrated north and south between Blue Flamingo and emos, and the commercial side of it manifested at emos and this underground, unbelievably underground aspect of it, you know, thrived at the Blue Flamingo, which is about the size of my living room and had no stage and, you know, was a very raw club. You know, Miss Laura used to joke that, you know, that the cliche is that gay men were wealthier, handsomer, better dressed, and had higher incomes than the average hetero, and Blue Flamingo is where the other gay men went.
Yes, so. That's pretty much it. Yeah. It was the Blue Flamingo. Yeah. You know, and unfortunately, I mean, that was, you know, I think we learned, very recently, like, you know, within the last couple of weeks that, you know, Miss Laura actually passed away, a couple of years ago. She'd kind of, I know Richard had been kind of, following her. She'd been in bad health for a while. But she finally did, just succumb to a whole raft of health issues that I think, you know, frankly, actually I think started when, you know, when the Blue Flamingo was still, open, but, the place, that she provided, was just, the right place at the right time. And it was I think she'd seen that, okay, well, there are people coming to the Cavity, and the Cavity was kind of going under, and she thought that, you know, it might make sense to start having bands in there, but it did become like a full on, scene in and of itself. And I think, you know, the bands, the Motards, I think, were definitely, if you had to pick a house band for the Blue Flamingo, they would definitely be it. And, you know, other garage bands like the Reclusives and the Chumps, and a whole ton of others, as well as some of the bands that, the Fuck Emos, Stratford, that you'd find those guys there a lot too. And you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't mention your band, Nate, the Nipple Five, who put on, had some wild nights at the Blue Flamingo.
That we did, full on barroom brawls with gunplay.
I don't think I've heard that story.
Well, you should have heard the gunplay for the book. It was something else. Somebody I'd never seen before. A fight broke out between the San Antonio band that was closing the show, and I feel really bad. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. And one of the patrons at the club that turned into a complete barroom brawl, which I'd never seen happen before in my life. And somebody I'd never seen before ran into the club and yells, "Get the gun," and jumps over the bar and pulls a .32 out from the cash register.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it was quite a night. But so yeah, the Blue Flamingo, anything could happen. And Greg, you've told us some of the stories in the book, but many, many more great stories in the book. The book is A Curious Mix of People, the underground scene of 90s Austin, as excellently chronicled by Greg Beats and Richard Weimark. Greg, thanks so much for coming on the show. And more importantly, thanks for chronicling the scene.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me, Nate. It's been a pleasure.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, we'll continue to Let Motown Roll with a recast of Nate and Brooks Long's discussion of Dave Ritz's co-written autobiography of the great Smokey Robinson. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.